Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 27 of Here We Go Again, Israeli Politics. We'd like to dedicate this week's episode to Eliyahu Kay, who was murdered this morning in Temple Mount. We send our thoughts and prayers to those wounded and to the families. Israeli prisoners released. Chief Rabbit makes a mess. Spy in Gantz's apartment? Supreme Court breaks our democracy. A horrific terrorist attack in Jerusalem, and we answer some questions. This is Here We Go Again. And for our first topic.
First, we would like to offer a correction for something that was stated last week. Last week, I reported a story about the head of the Avodah, and I falsely stated that the head of the Avodah is Miri Regev, whilst the head of the Avodah is Mirab Michaeli. Thank you for everyone who sent in the corrections. A slight screw up there. Now, on to our first topic of the week. We want to give an update on a story we reported at the end of last week's episode. Two Israelis were arrested for taking pictures of Erdogan, who is the president of Turkey's palace. They have officially been released back into the custody of Israel after extensive intervention from the Foreign Ministry of Israel and from the President of Israel and the Prime Minister of Israel and the President, actually. There was calls to Erdogan personally, and reportedly he personally intervened, and they were released. They also stated that they hope to move forward with their relations in Israel in the future. There's just a few comments on the political side of things. As usual, from the opposite side of the political aisle, they were thanking God for their and the work that was done to get them released, but never thanking anyone personally for actually having done anything. But that's the norm in this scenario.
So the question is, what happened behind the scenes? Which, you know, we gotta be granted, we are a political commentary podcast, but we don't know information that we are not given and it is not public. And the question is, there's two scenarios in which it happened. One time, we've seen this in the past, in which the arrest was purposeful, as in the arrest was in an not arresting them, but once they're arrested, then Erdogan would actually get involved and say, yeah, put them in jail so we can have an issue with Israel and then we can request what we need and force them to do X, Y, Z. And that has happened in the past. And in which case scenario, the fact that he made the arrest, forced the arrest to be ridiculous, and then decided to let them go means what are we missing here that we agreed to do?
What did we give up?
The other option is, and it is an option, is that this arrest happened, like, we know that letting them go was up to the level of Erdogan. Erdogan himself was involved with letting them go. We don't know that Erdogan himself was involved with the arrest. Okay, definitely not involved in the first second of the arrest because he's running a country and he has bigger things to deal with. The question is, when they were arrested, they caught them, they decided, they thought that they were spies or whatever other reasoning, they decided they arrested them because they were pissed at them. Once they were arrested, the question is, was Erdogan, and at what point was he put involved in the situation? And it is possible that he was arrested by whatever commander or general was in charge of there. They decided to throw him in. And at that point, later on, Erdogan really got involved and, yes, decided to let them go. Which could be a certain positive move where he's really saying, okay, yeah, there's things that I want, but also this is a good opportunity for us to push forward in a positive outcome.
Yes, and that does seem to be the more probable scenario, especially since during the mess, there was two sides of the Israeli government that intervened. There was the side that was stating that we'll deal with this, but don't stop going to Turkey for tourism. Turkey's a nice country and whatever. And there was the other side. This was actually a very interesting move played by Israel. And it was a dangerous move. So Israel had announced that they were going to move forward with recognizing the Armenian Holocaust under Israeli law, which means that some of the relations with Turkey have to be, they're mitigated until Turkey deals with some issues. And they were going to move forward finally recognizing it. For those not aware, there was a massive Holocaust that happened to the Armenians pre the Holocaust. And the world kind of ignores it because of who Turkey is. And it was an interesting move about whether or not this also affected the dealings with Erdogan on the matter. But once again, we can't know what happened behind the scenes.
And so the final outcome was that they were really released and returned to Israel. The one little tiny thing that I would want to point out, and I want to be careful to not jump to, like, crazy political assumptions here, because I don't think it's a big deal, and I would be annoyed if this was said by a news channel and they made it a big deal. But in the end, when, I don't remember her name, from the drug scene, which she actually also did a illegal act and then was arrested, and then Bibi Netanyahu was involved with her release. I'll remember her name in a couple minutes. And then as she lands back, Bibi Netanyahu was there to welcome her back to Israel, and it's a picture of all the family hugging and the prime minister, which makes her to be in the limelight. And at the end of the day, she was this couple, at least by what the public knows, was genuinely just in the wrong place in the wrong time, and are kind of a miskinim that they were arrested and sat in jail for 10 days and then were released. And guess who wasn't at the scene when they landed? Bennett. He wasn't there, not Yair Lapid either. They weren't there to, like, show off that they were involved, and they were directly involved in releasing him.
All they did was a phone call, like, congratulating them on coming home.
Which is wonderful. Again, I'm not jumping to massive political conclusions because of that. It's just something to state, which I think was nice and really not needed for them to be there at the time.
And if we already mentioned the media, it's a good segue to our next topic. This is not necessarily about Israeli politics, just about the media in general in Israel. For those who are not aware, there was a big profile case in the States this past week, Kyle Rittenhouse. We're not going to delve into the details of the case or about whether or not him getting off, him being acquitted from the jury is justified or not. We would just like to state that whilst we tend to follow American politics a lot, we also tend to look at the Israeli coverage of American politics. And this is where the issue arises. If you looked at Israeli news, you consistently saw a false picture of what happened. There were statements, for example, that Kyle Rittenhouse shot multiple African-American individuals. No one at the scene was black. All of the members of this incident were white. There were many false stories. It just goes to show that the Israeli media really needs to get its facts straight on stories, especially concerning foreign politics, before reporting on a story. Another issue that may have been reported on slightly last week was that Defense Minister Gantz apparently had one of his home cleaners arrested by the intelligence forces of Israel for apparently treason. He voluntarily contacted Iranian officials in hopes of sending them information and about Gantz and pictures of his home, claiming that he was in dire financial need and that he needed their help. He apparently took pictures of the inside of Gantz's home. Gantz is bills and the inside of his safe. All of this is not a very good look. It goes to the fact that the Shabak, which is the Defense Forces of Israel, specifically in charge of pretty much the Secret Service, failed here miserably, especially since the fact that this person has been arrested 5 times in the past for stealing things and theft and armed robbery. Not a good person in general. And this goes that clearly the vetting process here was not done well. Another security issue that just happened on the same day as that was that the car that the Shabak once again screwed up on was that the car of the head of Rosh Aman, who is the head of intelligence, was also stolen from under their watch.
Well, his wife's car. His wife's car was stolen from the parking lot of his private building. So the reason this is, on the one hand, big news, and not big news, is it wasn't his private car that has, there was nothing classified in there and there was no information and he's fine. It was really mainly just a failure. And the person that stole the car, by the way, had no idea that it was his wife's car. It wasn't a targeted attack. But none of that matters because he, as the head of the intelligence arm of the IDF, has security by the same organization, which is in charge of having the security of him. Now, it's different, to be clear, than security for, like, the prime minister or the defense minister, which are defending everything around him and constant have defense around him. They have the Shabak has the right to decide what level of defense everyone needs. But in the end, they failed because someone managed one of the things that's supposed to be secured is his family's home, as he is a person of interest. And people were able to really go into his private parking lot, the building's private parking lot, and steal his car.
It's a very big mess, and there's going to be an extensive investigation into what happened here, and reported it as it moves forward. So, the next topic is actually a court case that went in front of the Supreme Court. This is a court case discussing Mishu Shacham, who is a high-ranking police official who supposedly had a bunch of cases of sexual misconduct brought up against him, and it was a long, extensive case. We're not going to delve into that. The more important was the ruling in the case. The judges in the case just found that they could not find him guilty in any of the counts brought against him. But this is a quote. I'll read it in Hebrew and then translate it. הצטברות של מעשים לא תקינים, אך לא פליליים, לכשעצמם, יכולה לאפשר הרשעה. למעשה הם קבעו שבנסיבות מסוימות 0 ועוד 0 שווה 1. They stated that a multitude of unethical actions, but they are not necessarily illegal themselves, can have a guilty verdict. They have decided that 0 plus 0 equals to 1. This is a terrible precedent to say. It pretty much gave judges the ultimate power. Now, before we get to the effect this might have on Netanyahu himself, this is a major blow for the system. This is stating that the law has no effect. They truly believe that they are the ultimate power because the law means nothing now. Because if the law states that I'm free, but the judges say, yes, but you were shady on two different issues, but legally you're free, then they could still throw you in jail for life. This strips away the rights from every citizen of this country. This is a terrible blow for our democracy.
I am so angry. I read this and it really gets me heated and terrified of what is happening in this country. I really can't even understate this to our listeners. This is terrifying on a country level. Do you understand the statement that they are saying? They are saying what you did is not illegal. It's not. There is no law saying what you did is illegal, but you did a lot of things that are almost illegal, so let's just decide that together they're illegal. That is literally one of the scariest things I can ever hear someone say. It literally just means no matter what you do, and we write a rule book, and if you obey that rule book, but you're sketchy, you're going to jail for that. It is the worst thing in a long time, and you know I've expressed my opinions on the Supreme Court, and I've expressed my opinions that I have against their views and against their decision making, but I tend to be careful calling them evil. I tend to be careful calling them just corrupt and against society, and this is the definition. This isn't even a snowball effect towards destroying society. This is destroying society.
Now, and just to give a little bit more information on the fact of this case, that they got him on in the end. They're saying that 0 plus 0 equals to 1 on hafarat emunim, which is breaking the trust, breaking the public trust, which is the pretty much the vaguest term you can take, which is say, you didn't break anything, but we don't like what you did. And why do they do this? This is so brazenly political that it's disgusting. The only person that this entire case is about is not the accused and not the public. It is about Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister who has three indictments against him. Because what they managed to set a precedent here is that even if he is acquitted on all three separate cases, they can then say, yes, but what your actions here were not good, and therefore we're going to throw you in jail because all three separate cases together add to bad actions. And that is clearly what this precedent was set about, because they can't just set the precedent for him. So it's just a disgusting maneuver from the courts that is so brazenly political that I don't know, and I truly would love to hear someone who honestly likes and defends the courts send us in a question, send us a response stating, how would you defend this action? How would you state that this action was acceptable from the Supreme Court of Israel? Not just judicial activism, they're essentially disregarding the legislator completely.
So I can give you the answer that one will give. And part of the statement is that in Israel, and the way the Supreme Court looks at it in Israel, is that the idea of their job is justice. It's not law, it's justice. And therefore, if it is just to put someone in jail, that is what will happen. That's why you have the high courts. You know, if you would compare it right now, it's almost like if you go by in the Tanakh and you learn about Moshe Rabbeinu, then you sit and say, yeah, there wasn't a real clear set of rules for everything. We came, you gave your views, he gave his views, and like a father in a house, he came and decided what was right. That's how the Supreme Court sees themselves. And that's how the supporters of the Supreme Court see themselves as well. They see the Supreme Court as the ultimate justice that's supposed to be enforced. And therefore, if Nisa Shacham, and definitely if Benjamin Netanyahu, is acquitted legally because the law book does not give them the power to do so, they'll take the power on their own because it's not just. And that is the fear, and that is because, and the problem with that, many of us will say, what's wrong with that? And I've asked this question as well. Okay, if the person is clearly a scumbag, which again, we're not defending Nisa Shacham as a person. He did a lot of pretty nasty things. And I do not think that I would want him to be friends or want him to be dating my daughter. But there's a law. And the way that we believe the law is it works is that when you declare laws, I, as a citizen, should have the freedom and the right to read those laws, obey those laws, and never have a fear of losing my liberties. That is something we don't have in this country.
I completely agree. But again, even onto that account, I don't understand someone who defends the courts or states, but what happens when someone else sits in that seat? Eventually, someone else will sit in that seat. Just like we're discussing now, we're hopefully going to discuss later this episode or next week, the replacement of the Yamash. Someone else will eventually fill that seat. What if it's not someone you agree with? How do they respond to that?
Well, first of all, I don't think they believe they'll ever lose because they don't have that problem because the Supreme Court in Israel chooses themselves. And therefore, they do not have that fear of losing their positions. They can veto anyone that has to come in that's not in their views. With that, they're not looking long term. I said this on many, many things. Here I'm going to blame the government as well. We are not good in this country at ever looking at long term effects of things.
I agree, but there are one thing that's long-term, that eventually, we like to state that right-wing government eventually of 61 could fix all of this in a minute. At a certain point, you hit a point of no return where the judicial system has taken steps too far and cannot be fixed. But so we want to go on to another governmental body, well, governmental body-ish, that did not do good actions this week. Rav Rashi, the chief rabbinate of Israel for the Sephardi faction, had some very harsh words to say about the minister of religions and about the Rav stuff. Now, we tend in this podcast to avoid necessarily discussing religious topics, seeing as that's not necessarily what our listeners would like to hear. But seeing this is a very political matter, we felt it was important to discuss. He stated as follows, I'll just quote some of his statements. The pilot acts brazenly and arrogantly and against us. He has no fear of God and he acts with prejudice against us. And many more quotes like this. Now, just to give a little bit of background on the story. The head of the Minister of Religions, Matan Kahana, has been working on major reforms in the Ministry of Religions, mainly to take away the monopoly of kashrus and gil and weddings, and take away the massive jobs industries that the Shas Haredi faction, which is the Sephardi faction of the Haredis, have appointed for themselves. Now, as a result, the chief rabbinate of Israel have refused to talk to him. They refused to work with him at all. And then they get mad at him that he's working without them. Now, as for the reform themselves, we're hoping to have on in a few weeks a few people to discuss the specifics of the reforms, but we're not getting into that. I would just like to get into the precedent that this set. The chief rabbinate of Israel draws his power from a law that was passed in the 1980s, stating what exactly will be the jurisdiction of the chief rabbinate. Again, this states what the jurisdiction of the chief rabbinate council will be, not the chief rabbi himself. And so, as a result, a parliament, just like the Knesset in the 1980s, could strip that power from him. If his power stems from the government, then it stems from the government. If his power stems from the public, for those who are not aware, the chief rabbinate of Israel is not supported by most of the public. Most of the Tilomi community does not like them at all, does not trust them and does not like them, does not support the things that they do, and they feel often that they are acting against their interests. So they definitely don't draw their support from the public. As a result, he has no authority to act against the government. He is a government-appointed employee. No matter what position, he cannot act against the will of the government. No matter what government it is. If he is so unhappy with what is happening, then he has the right, and even someone might say the obligation, to publicly resign and then speak out. once he holds this position, he has no right or authority to speak against the government and to act actively against the will of the government and laws that were passed by Knesset Israel.
So I slightly disagree with you. And I think that one of the things that I promised myself during this is I need to be objective, okay? It's very easy to sit there and say, you know, in my this current situation, yeah, I mean, I support Matan Kahana's views. I am a modern Orthodox Jew, and I think that what he's pushing is right. And I think that what the Haredis have given us in many, many fields has given us many issues in this country. With that, I'm trying to paint the same exact situation, assuming that I vehemently disagreed with what the Minister of Religion was doing. Let me give you a different example. What if the Minister of Religion was actually... This government had not a single right-wing, not a single religious person in the government. And this, and they managed to pull over and take over a majority of anti-religion or anyone. Imagine someone from Meretz becoming the Minister of Religion. There's not a legal problem with that. They have the right to be. It does not say in any law that the Minister of Religion has to be a religious man. And at that point, he is now actively trying to undermine any religious things in this country. I would expect the chief rabbi, to fight out against that. And let me give you another example which would be different. And even more extreme where you work under. In the army, in the IDF, we have a serious issue there now. This has been happening for many years, where the rabbinical council in the army is slowly losing more and more power and becoming a... Many years, all the way back to Shlomo Goren, which literally was an aloof to the, you know, a brigadier general, second in the tier of commands in the army, to slowly becoming now lower and lower and less powerful. And I would come and say that if the Ramatkal, the chief staff of the army, came out and did things against the kashrus and against the religion, I expect the rabbi of the army to go fighting against him, even though he's his commander. Fighting against him on the result that then he could be fired and he could be removed. And then as people, we would riot against that. But he protests against that. But he does not need to lower his head to them. And in this situation also, again, taking out your personal views, if they believe that Matan Kahana is trying to ruin the kashrus in this country, then they should be fighting against him with all their might, but he should have the right to fire them.
So, no. And I'll explain what I mean. So you have to distinguish between the position in the army and the position in the public. A, because the army, once again, he is considerably more dependent on the Ramatkal. The Ramatkal can fire him at any point. Also, in the job description of the rabbi of the army is to protect the religious rights of the soldiers. It's not the same position. That is not the position of the chief rabbi. The chief rabbi is meant to promote religion and to promote... different issues. He has pretty much become a figurehead, just like the president of Israel, who's supposed to go to events, sit there and look pretty. He's not meant to...
Who stated that? Is that the law?
No.
Is that written in the law? I don't know why you're agreeing that. They look at it very differently.
The law does not state his specific powers, aside from the fact that will be the head of the Batei Din of Israel, even though he's not a Dayan.
Good. Now, so it's not specific.
Fact, that 1 second. Now, let's state for a moment that, let's say, Tamar Zandberg tomorrow was the head of the religions department, and she was going on a full-out attack on religion. Let's say that was true. Once again, you cannot abide something from in that. You cannot put out a fire from inside the house. That is the point. You publicly, you and everyone else with you, resign.
No.
That is the limit. You cannot fight. You do not fight from within the government.
He's not in the government.
He is in a government-appointed employee.
Then they can fire him. That doesn't mean that he has to obey her orders. She's not his commander.
She is.
No, she's not.
She's his boss.
That doesn't make her a commander. That means that I have the right as a worker to come out against what you're doing, and then you have the right to fire me. I don't need to quit. Again, this is not an appointed position in which I'm appointing you to service me. That's not the position. I would say that more about the Yoamash, which is literally the Yoetz HaMishpati Lemshala, which theoretically, in my view, is supposed to be supporting the government. He is not appointed to help the Minister of Religion do her ways. No, he has a separate position. If she does not like what he's doing, she has the right to fire him, or he in our situation.
Well, he doesn't. And my point would be that still, I'm not discussing a legal matter here about whether or not he has the legal right to do this. I'm discussing morally, and I don't think it's right for a governmental appointee to work against the government from within. I think he has to resign publicly and then speak out ferociously against the acts of the government. But I don't think it's correct for you to stem your authority from this government and then act against it.
Okay, so I will agree on one point that I want to make clear in my own statement, and that's the fact that there's a big difference between speaking out and ignoring. Those are both legitimate for me. He has the right to say, I will not meet with you. Until you could fire me again, but I will not meet with you. And also has the right to speak out however he feels and can be fired for it. The one thing I would say I don't agree is that he cannot act with other employees against the Minister of Religion.
Which he has specifically, and I will say that
is incorrect. If the Minister of Religion passes a law, and therefore that law states that any, you know, store has to do this, therefore has to be open, he cannot tell them, he cannot go to his the people that he's in charge of, and say, you have to act differently against the law, that would be illegal from my perspective.
The resolution here is that either way we need to find a new status quo of balancing religion and government, which has been problematic since the foundation of this government. But on to our next topic. The ethics committee for this government has finally been founded for this Knesset, sorry, not this government. The ethics committee, who was meant to judge when different parliamentarians act unethically, has not existed since the foundation of this Knesset, stating that there was not a broad enough consensus on founding one. This week it was finally created. It has three members, but it could not ever meet because A, the opposition has one member and the coalition has two. The opposition member quit immediately. And the coalition member, one of them, Usama Saadi, quit from the ethics committee, most likely because that he did not want to censor Ayman Uda, the Arab parliamentarian, for pushing Itamar Ben-Gvir in the hospital. And as a result, the committee cannot convene since they doesn't have a majority of their members.
Can you remind us the role of the ethics committee is?
So it's kind of vague in the law. But every country has an ethics committee as part of their parliament. It's meant to censure and censor different parliamentarians for acting on ways that are truly unethical, okay? For example, last week in the United States, a congressman was censored publicly by the ethics committee for posting a video of him in anime killing another congresswoman. Now, should that have been censored? Maybe, maybe not. Irrelevant. It's just part of their job is to say when someone tracks truly unethically part of the board, you can fine them, you can censor that, you can censure them. There's different ways that they can act against and punish different parliamentarians as a result of unethical actions. Sexual misconduct is usually on the top of that list. Speaking prolifically or disobeying the rules of the Knesset or different matters like that, or against physical harming of another Chavar Knesset, it would also count on that list.
So, basically, that means that now Ayman Uda gets out of it? He doesn't have a problem anymore?
I mean, he always got out of it, but up until an ethics committee ever actually meets, and then they can discuss it.
Okay, so to me, the main issue I just have is it's just like the two-facedness of it, you know, and I mentioned this before, so I mentioned just one in one line, but in the end, I feel that many times on the right, and you definitely hear on the podcast as well, that we are, you know, we're all right-wing conservatives, and we still bash the right wing and we still tell the right wingers when they do something wrong. We say, yeah, that was wrong. You shouldn't do that. And I just constantly feel that on the left, when they do something wrong, that the left will agree is wrong. They'll just find any excuse to defend it. And I think it's just a little, I don't want to say the word immature, but it just really disturbs me. And we see it here as well. You know, I'm a dude that clearly did something wrong. And again, trust me. If one of the Knesset members that I support shoved another Knesset member, I would attack him for that. I would say that is not the way that I expect a Knesset member to act, and I feel it's not being done on the other side. That's just disappointing in my views.
I agree. And either way, I think an ethics committee is an important part of the government. Whether or not the rules of the ethics committee need to be shored up, I think is irrelevant in the scenario. An ethics committee is important to try and create civil discourse in the Knesset, which anyone who ever turns on the channel of the Knesset can clearly see is lacking from it. And to an update on Corona, the vaccines for children 5 to 11 have been approved and have been flown into Israel. Now, I am not happy about this. And let me explain what I mean, so I don't get misquoted. Very happy for them to be approved. I don't like how the committee did it. The committee originally announced that it was going to be a public hearing, that all of the information was going to be open for the public to hear. And then they decided to close it. Now, I'm not a doctor, I don't know anything about vaccines for children, and I wouldn't have enough to pontificate intelligently about that. However, if you want people to go vaccinate their children, all information must be available. It is incredibly shady when you're voting on whether or not to approve this measure that you have to hide what your vote is. Yes, you're going to be held accountable. I, as a public citizen who you want me to go vaccinate my child, I would like to know what exactly why you're approving this or why you voted against it. I want to hear the debate on this matter. This committee should never have closed its doors to the public. There should have been cameras that were very clearly shown on every news channel. Because this is a contentious issue. Because as of right now, they're not forcing children into vaccines. They're not. However, do I see it happening that in a month, 2 months, every child 5 to 11 has to get a vaccine in this government? Easily. And then I'm going to be annoyed. And then I'm going to be very annoyed because it wasn't clear enough and it wasn't a thing. Aside from the fact that it wouldn't support a vaccine mandate, especially for ages 5 to 11, because there isn't enough risk for them to prove that it was required. It's not a children's sickness. It's not needed. I'm not saying I'm against vaccine mandates in general. I'm saying in this specific scenario. Either way, all information should have been made public and available to everyone. It should not have been hidden at all.
Okay, so I disagree with you on two fronts here. First of all, your statement that it is not a child's disease. Again, we're very careful on this podcast. You know, there's just so much information and it's always being updated. So, like, we're not here to be the COVID professionals, not at all.
We're not.
But again, to be careful and stated, there is the PIMS condition that many, many kids are weeks after being a positive with corona are getting very, very sick and being hospitalized in intense care. So there is that fear. But we have to understand the reasoning they shut this committee, okay? Now, many, many times, 99% of the time, I agree with you, okay? Never shut a committee. Committees are public for the public to see. And if decisions are being made, the public has the right to see those. With that, the heads of the committee that are not politicians, the heads of the committee that are hired to be there as professionals, were constantly getting death threats. Real, true death threats to
and
their lives.
Horrible.
Okay? Again, so to their lives. And they said they would quit. Okay? Because this is dangerous for their lives and their children's lives. And ruining their lives because they're trying, in the end, you could agree or disagree with their views. They are there solely. There's not anything political there. I'm not saying there's nothing political in the committee. There's a lot political in the committee. Their specific positions, the ones that were being threatened, are there for professional reasons. And that is what they were saying, is that to make sure that, yes, in the end, here's the six people that are there. This is the committee that was decided here. We can then give you the professional reasons separately. But when there's a debate, and you're going to sit there saying we shouldn't vaccine them, and I'm going to sit there saying as a medical professional, which I am not, but let's say I was there saying, no, I'm telling you and I'm going to convince you that you must do it. Therefore, anyone that's watching that is going to go to my house and riot later because I professionally am saying that it needs to happen. That's dangerous.
I'm sorry, but you are making public policy and you need to be held accountable. I'm not obviously rioting and thing. Leave these people alone. That's not what I'm saying. My point is that they need to be held accountable because they are making public policy. They are publicly appointed officials that are making public policy. They are dictating public policy and as a result need to be held accountable for that public policy. As in, I need to see their decision. And as to the reasonings, I don't want a report later that could have been mishwashed. I want when you are sitting there discussing this matter, I would like to know what are the different reasonings that were made and what convinced you to vote to approve this vaccine for children that will eventually might force this vaccine onto children. Now, onto a similar thing, but a little bit different. There was a report that came out, a news report, stating about which children of the parliamentarians were getting the vaccine. They went around the Knesset asking different people whether or not their children are getting a vaccine, and they did a whole thing about any of members of the Knesset that were unsure or they mumbled a little bit on it instead of saying immediately yes. With all due respect, until the matter when they go and force it on everyone, it's none of your business. It's not the parliament, it's not the member of Knesset himself, and they're not forcing it onto anyone at the moment. they are offering the opportunity for anyone who wants to get a vaccine. And as a result, it is their personal medical decision of the child. It has no effect on how he performs as a member of Knesset. And until he decides to force vaccine on other children, it has no effect on public policy. It is his personal decision about his personal family, and I do not think it is relevant in any way, in any manner, to whether I'm onto this discussion. I think it is their personal decision. And if someone was to say no, and if someone was to say, mumble a little bit and say, I don't know, I haven't decided yet, that's a completely legitimate answer. And they should not be ostracized for taking seriously the medical decisions of their children.
Okay, do you agree that the day they force it upon everyone, I can ask every politician publicly and say, okay, that's fine then. At first, I thought you were saying differently. If it's because it's a freedom of choice, then I agree that it's a choice. But the second it does not become a choice, it is definitely, I want a report.
It's a public,
then I want a public report of every minister, every Knesset member, which of his children was vaccinated. It's not because it is a legal requirement that you require the citizens to do as well.
That is a public policy matter. This is not.
I agree.
And therefore, I think it should not be doing it. Now, onto a slightly different topic and a more somber topic. We would like to report on an attack that happened this morning in the Old City. A Palestinian ran out with a automatic weapon and fired. He was taken down in the police claim in precisely 32 seconds. The result was 2 critically injured and 1 person who has sadly passed away.
Eliyahu K, 26 years old, made Aliyah from South Africa, worked in the Kotel.
And was set to be married in a few weeks. Truly a very terrible and sad story. And now on to the facts of the matter. The biggest issue is that in the Old City, and especially in the Har HaBayit, which is the Temple Mount, Palestinians that go up to the Temple Mount are not required to go through metal detectors. It has been a big debate for a very long time in Israel. One of the previous governments had actually instituted metal detectors, and then because of pressure from the Jordanian government, they removed metal detectors that were set up there. As a result, the political players on the field have all decided to react in different ways. Yoaz Hendon, for example, who is one of the ministers, said that we must ensure that no one goes into Jerusalem armed, Jews or Palestinians, it doesn't matter. And then after blowback onto this comment, he clarified what he meant was anyone coming in with illegal weapons. Anyone who coming in with a gun license obviously is acceptable. And he said that that metal detectors must go back up, and that it's to remind everyone that the right-wing government, that the people on the right that are shouting about this are the people who took down the metal detectors in the first place. The Likud demanded that Mansour Abbas and the Ra'am party come out against this attack in an unequivocal manner.
So, except for this being so sad and so difficult, and for those who may have, and I hope many of you have not, but seen the video of the man just screaming for help, running away, and then hearing an automatic gun go off, and then complete silence. But when it comes in the end that we are a political podcast and we talk about the political ramifications of an issue, there's a lot political here. Now, a couple matters I want to touch. One that you discussed really is the security measures that are taken in the mount, that they do not go through basically any security checks. And security checks they do go through are done by the Palestinians and the Jordanian waqf that's there. And that is the result. You know, there's no scenario this could have happened if there were security checks there. We also know that they pile up stones and rocks within the Temple Mount, their supposed super holiest place. This is just a war zone area from them.
It's also important to note that this apparently was a premeditated attack, since it just been reported that the wife of the terrorist, Fadi Abu Shahdam, fled to Jordan a few days ago. In anticipation of the blowback from this event.
And that connects me to the second issue here, which is really the issue of how this could have been avoided. And the first part is, as I said, that it could have been avoided by having security checks there. And the second part is that this man, or more accurate, how it could be avoided is, how is this man, for those of you who don't know, was a teacher hired by the Jerusalem municipality. He was paid by the Jerusalem Municipality of Israel to teach in Arab schools. he was a sheikh that is taught, and then you get to this situation where, again, premeditated means that this was a planned attack and got an automatic weapon that he entered the mount with. How this happened is a complete downfall. The third part I want to point out, which is one of the hardest parts of this entire situation, was the immediate reaction. As this event happened, he shot them, then he was shot. There were three wounded, one that unfortunately passed away, unfortunately was murdered, and another two that were, one was critically wounded and one was lightly wounded. And what happened was, is that the immediate reaction was, I saw the first post saying, the mountain was closed. Now, I understand that. We need to detain the issue. We need to make sure that no one else comes in. There's a lot of security forces and medics that are entering. We are shutting down entrance to the mountain to take care of the issue. Legitimate. Oh no, wait. But that wasn't the truth. The truth says they shut down the mountain for Jews. Which means all of the entrances for the Arabs to continue coming into the mountain, the same entrances in which this terrorist came in from, were not closed. No. To deal with an Arab terrorist that shot Jews, we decided to shut down the entrance for Jews. Until this moment, currently, there's still no entrance for Jews into the mountain. That is horrific. And it just shows the mandate and the view that they have on this situation. Now, you're going to come and say, for security reasons, you have to deal with the thing. First of all, I disagree. There are things that are above that. Second of all, for security reasons, shut down the whole mountain. And if you are too scared to shut down the mountain from the Arabs, then you have a sovereignty issue that you have to deal with. The fourth and last point I want to get to is slightly unfair political jumps towards this current government. Immediately.
Before that, I think it's also very important to pay attention. Whilst the police got the attacker down, the terrorist down very quickly, their announcement just a few minutes later led to some criticism of them. The Mafkal stated that the terrorist was known to the police, but not because of any terrorist actions. And then afterwards, the Minister for Interior Defense, Omar Walev, stated that the terrorist was a man from Hamas, from the active part of Hamas, that would daven almost constantly in the old city. And that his wife fled 3 days ago from the country. Now, I don't know how they possibly could have gotten this information that quickly. If they had this information in advance, then something should have been looked into here. Something should have been done in advance.
So I can agree, but then this is also like, this is just the definition of when you fail. You know, you can't expect them to stop every terrorist ever. And I don't blame securities. I blame them for obvious things that they should have seen, like a woman fleeing. Well, not fleeing, but leaving when it's a pretty simple system. When a wife of a Muslim flies to Jordan, you are able to have a security check to understand what's happening. But even then, I'm not going to jump and blame them for him, for not catching him before trying to make this attempt. I will be more accurate, when you succeed in stopping a terrorist attack before it happens, I give you a kol hakavod and I say an amazing job. When you are unsuccessful, I don't come blame you for that. I blame you for not being able to have security measures there, for not having security stopping him from entering with the weapons. And that connects to my point of what this current government is. I think it's totally unfair to come and blame him. Look at what you're doing, you're weak. Everything, obviously, on both sides are bashing. I think it's ridiculous. Because the event right now has nothing to do with politics. You know what will have to do with politics? The event that happens, chas v'shalom, in 3 days from now, or in 2 weeks from now, or in 2 months from now. And I will say it right now in front of everyone listening, that if in the next couple days, weeks, or months, a similar terrorist attack happens on Temple Mount, I will blame one single person, and that is Naftali Bennett. The Prime Minister of Israel will be personally to blame for any terrorist attack that happens in the next few months in the Temple Mount, and I'm saying it right here and right now.
Now, we also, as I stated earlier, received a question from last week's episode. The question is as follows. We are libertarians and conservatives, and as a result, we tend to refrain from having government intervention in most things in life. Now, the question that we got sent is, what do we perceive as the government's... How could the government affect change in a positive manner?
Well, this came as a result of our statement last week regarding the tax on chad pami, on plasticware. And we discussed that, you know, the many things that you could list the last week's podcast that were against this taxation. And then the question came up, a very fair and true question of saying, I can hear your issues at the tax, but how do you stop that? As in, how do you help citizens be better about the environment? How do you help them be better educated on this matter? What is the government's role in this situation?
So why don't you give us your opinion first, and then I'll respond.
So my opinion is built of a couple options, okay? First of all, I understand the question. And I, different than you might disagree with me in a moment, I do believe that the government has certain places that I think that they can intervene and they can be relevant to pushing things forward, okay? But I think that there are three rules that must obey for this to happen. The first rule is the clear separation between things that harm yourself and things that harm others, okay? Anything that harms yourself, I believe that is your complete right. That is your complete right as a citizen, and you can do what you feel is safe and fit to you. And I do not believe that the government knows better what is dangerous or healthy for you as an individual.
Well, before we get to my opinion, I think you have to define self-harm, because we don't allow someone to attempt suicide or inflict pain onto themselves unnecessarily.
So, first of all, it's very complicated legally what we allow and don't allow a certain person to do. And even that, we are only declaring it when we go towards someone trying to specifically kill themselves. It is not illegal for me to break my leg, okay? If I am annoyed and I want to break my leg, I do not go to jail for breaking my own leg. Okay. It's a special caveat for psychological issues that one has when it brings to suicide. And even with that, by the way, I'm not sure I agree with it. I'm not jumping and saying I disagree with it, but it's a bit of a specific topic when it comes to suicide and whether or not those people are proving that they're not healthy enough to be taken care of. And it's a very interesting topic that we could talk about a different time about allowing sick people to end their life. And therefore, it's an interesting topic that I have a different opinion on.
But to play devil's advocate for a moment, what about the claims that you are costing me money in the general medical system that we all pay for?
So I said, so 1 second. So that is the second part of my rule, okay? So the first part here is whether or not you're harming yourself. Okay, a classic example would be, in my legal opinion, it is absolutely ridiculous that I can get a ticket for driving a car without a seatbelt on. I'm not saying I would ever do that. Of course I should. But I personally decide to not put a seatbelt on and therefore endangering myself. That's my complete right to do. But can I make a law on the fact that children in the backseat have to be seatbelt buckled? Of course, for two reasons. One, you're talking about a minor, okay? And you're talking about a third party, which is also my responsibility. And therefore, if I want to endanger myself, it's fine, but I'm still responsible for the other people in my car, and I don't have the right to endanger them. So that's the first part of my rule. The second part, as you said, has to do with the fact of the question of whether or not it harms others. Now, let's assume that it does harm others, okay? Now, there's direct and indirect, and I will say this very shortly. One would be obvious if I'm directly endangering others, like if I'm smoking a cigarette next to you, therefore I'm directly endangering you at this point. And that's why there are rules and laws against that. And I support those laws because they're hurting you. And the other ones are indirect, which is the point you just touched, which is the question of, if I'm unhealthy, therefore I'm going to be medically needing a thing, then therefore I'm going to be in the hospital and then costing the country money. Now, that's fine. There are two issues with that. One, we have to understand for our listeners, especially those in the States, that the system works differently in Israel. That's the only reason what you're saying is relevant, because we have a social medical care system. If we had a private medical system, I would say that's not relevant. If I want to make myself unhealthy, that will just cost me more money. But because we are in a social medical system and therefore it costs others more money, I would agree with you. But it's a very, very complicated and vague how you decide that. If I eat a hamburger, which obviously everyone can eat, I am somewhat making myself less healthy, which means that I can have a heart attack at age 50. So there are certain things that we can maybe agree on, but it's very, very complicated to get in what are the rules that I'm endangering myself more or less endangering myself. And that's why I think it's very complicated to make those laws. The third and last point I have is the matter of how this can be manageable, okay? What does this mean? And I'm sure you're going to touch it in a moment. We're going to get to the question of how do you choose what you tax and what you don't tax. And we could talk about people flying in jets and therefore it costs, is making much, much worse than me consuming plasticware for the next 50 years. But I think it comes down to one more point that I'm going to make is that let's say the government does intervene, okay? And this is what the situation I will say. I say he can intervene in two ways. One, he can intervene in positive reinforcement. I'm okay with that. I don't mind the government coming and actively intervening and saying, look, if you buy a dishwasher, okay, and you don't own one today, and you consume XYZ, therefore you're going to get this and this benefit for me to help you be able to do that. Or I could come and say, if you end up, you know, for example, if when it came to the child, the security seat that they needed for children, which I think is a wonderful idea. I just don't think you should be taxing someone who does, not you should be charging someone who doesn't have it, giving a fine. You should be positively reinforcing and saying, if you install this seat, which means you are a safer vehicle, we will lower the insurance that you have yearly on your vehicle. Those are positive reinforcements, and I have no problem with the government intervening with that. And the one last thing, sorry for this long point here, so the one last thing to do is if the government is going to intervene and is going to tax you, I would make a law that the money that is taxed must be spent for the same reason it was taxed. Therefore, if you're going to tax on plasticware for conserving the environment, then exactly the amount, you just made 250 million shekels more this year on that tax, that means you have to add to the budget of education for environment or safety, saving the environment or any other reason, you should have to reinforce it into taxation, into money, the money into that taxation. Like it for an example, saying we just hurt the weakest part of this country, the ultra orthodox, with this tax, then we should be taking all of that money and we should be making big sales and funding for first family dishwashers. You want to actually help the system, then help the situation and don't just tax it.
So, I'll take, I happen to agree with you on most of your points, but I'll work in the inverse order. So, it's not necessarily, I don't necessarily agree with the statement that they need to necessarily do positive reinforcement. I don't mind with negative reinforcement on certain issues, but I also have a few demands in the first place. I must have the goal very clear. I don't like the idea of hurting the consumer, i.e., let's take the plastic tag, for example, okay? We're discussing plates, cups, whatever. If my issue is mainly, okay, the hurting of the environment, great, then you tax the manufacturer. It still comes down to the consumer in the end, but it's very clear that the goal here is to lower the emissions. And how do we know that the goal is to lower the emissions? Because, let's say they could do that, the companies will then go on and try to figure out better ways. They will innovate ways to hopefully help and lower their cost to the environment, because they realize that any cost that they have to the environment gets taxed. If they want to lower their prices or stay competitive, they're going to have to attempt to find a way to better their product for the environment. As to, on the other hand, with no matter what they do, that price will still get taxed on, and it's only taxed on to the consumer and not to the provider, meaning they don't necessarily have an incentive so much to work for it to be removed. Now, a few other reasonings that I require for this to go into place is that I happen to believe that for things like this to take place, there must be a truly broad consensus. Now, I'm not discussing the specifics of this case. I'm talking about any matter we're discussing. Okay? Yes, smoking bad. Smoking very clearly bad, and there's a very broad consensus in the public that it's bad. Even a lot of people that smoke will agree that it's bad. It's also very medically proven that it's bad. Once you have a very broad consensus in the public, that gives you more freedom to act on the matter. I'm also okay with the government outlawing certain things. Societies throughout history have always outlawed certain things. Would I rather be done on a more municipal level? Of course. Would I rather a certain town or city ban smoking entirely? Yes. But I'm okay with it with a broader consensus. I'm not okay with things that, to me, seem petty. Okay? For example, the tax on sugar drinks was dumb. It's dumb, A, because it just angered most of the populace. B, because it was done in a bad manner. It wasn't done to hopefully make the drinks healthier. Because if that was the goal, as we discussed the goal on the first part, if the goal was to make the drinks healthier, then Coke Zero would not have been included in this tax. Or other such drinks like that. It was a tax mainly to raise money. And that, I believe, is the biggest issue. The goals must be set clear in advance so that everyone can judge them upon this matter. Because for if the goal is not clear and then the objective cannot be reached.
I agree, and one of the ways that I think you made the goal clear is that all money that is made by it must be spent on that same reasoning. And with that, we'd like to conclude this week's episode. We thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed. We will see you next week. We would like to end with our condolences for the family of Eliyahu K that was murdered this morning in Temple Mount, and send our thoughts and prayers to the families of those wounded. May we have a quiet and peaceful week. We'll see you next week. This is Here We Go Again.